Good morning. Welcome to episode 31 of the Driller Newscast, a weekly update on the news and stories impacting the water well and industrial drilling industry. I'm your host, Brock Yorty. This week in the news, the Navajo Nation received $73 million in water infrastructure money, a long-awaited project in the works since 2009. Our feature story of the week is a discussion with Jesse Richardson, legal counsel for the Water System Council. Today, October 3rd, is the opening arguments to the Sackett versus the EPA at the United States Supreme Court. The question presented is, should Rapanos be revisited to adopt the plurality test for wetlands jurisdiction under the Clean Water Act? But before we jump into this legal battle, let's talk safety. For this week's safety topic, I want to talk about hearing conservation, noise mitigation. This is a very important topic to our industry. We've covered it before, but I think we need to go more in depth. Many construction workers lose their hearing at a young age. It is not just a problem for older workers. In fact, construction workers experience hearing loss at a younger age than the general population. Think about that Gen Z, youngest of millennials coming in. Starts today to protect your hearing. According to NIOSH, the average 25-year-old construction worker has the hearing of a 50-year-old person. And we think we work in a hazardous condition with loud noises and it's just part of the job and there's nothing we can do about it. This is not the case. We can protect our hearing. We need to download the NIOSH decibel meter noise app and walk around our job site and understand how we're being exposed to these dangerous noise levels and what can be done to control and protect our hearing. Do you have trouble hearing people when there's background noise? Do people sound like they're mumbling? Do you have to ask people to repeat themselves? Does your spouse, your loved ones, your friends ask why the radio or the TV is on so loud? Do you have trouble hearing people on the phone? Or the big one, do you have constant ringing in your ears? You're not alone. 50 million people in the U.S. have tendonitis. In addition to that ringing sound, it can also sound like hissing, buzzing, roaring, chirping, or whistling. It's a sign that there's something wrong with your auditory system. We need to be doing yearly checkups to know what we're doing to our hearing. This auditory system includes the ear, the auditory nerve that connects the inner ear to the brain, and the parts of the brain that process sound. Tinnitus is serious. Tinnitus can be caused by noise-induced hearing loss and some health conditions, including ear and sinus infections, brain tumors, and certain medications and drugs. Being exposed to loud noises can result in temporary hearing loss lasting 16 to 48 hours. Nothing can be done to fix your hearing once it's permanently damaged. Noise-induced hearing loss is preventable. We need to think about what we're doing and how it's going to affect the job site as we get more and more damage done to our ears. You know, this is one of those slow situations. It's not like getting our finger smashed in the table or, you know, a near miss from a suspended load. These are serious situations that take time to damage, and then one day you just realize you're kneeling down to listen to your youngest niece or nephew or your grandchild. Hearing loss interferes with our communication on job site, makes it difficult for warning signals to be, you know, relayed in that catastrophic event. It can impact a person's sense of balance, leading to an increased risk of falling. Exposure to excessive noise can also increase stress, blood pressure, and can lead to nervousness, sleepiness, and fatigue. So if we think about those hierarchy of controls, I can't eliminate the noise on the job site. I have to acknowledge that we have a hazard. We can attempt to get quieter equipment, we can look for the best in, you know, noise reduction, but it's going to come right down to, we're there. We can't be eliminated from the hazard. We're going to have the best PPE possible. So how do you select the right hearing protection for noise you're being exposed to? Hearing protection devices are tested in a laboratory to determine how much noise they block from reaching your ears. This is called the Noise Reduction Rating, or NRR. The EPA requires manufacturers to list that noise reduction rating on hearing protection devices. However, lab conditions are not the same as our workplace conditions and generally are off by at least 7 decibels. So I want you to grab that set of earplugs you have, or muffs, or noise reduction hearing protection, and I want you to look at that noise reduction rating. Let's say it's a 33. So what I want you to do, I want you to subtract 7 from that 33 and then divide the results by 2. So if we go 33 minus 7 is 26, 26 divided by 2 is 13. Subtracting that number, 13, from our noise exposure, let's say it's 95 decibels on that rig. We got our NIOSH app out. Now we see that our hearing protection is reducing us from 95 minus 13 to 82, which is a permissible exposure limit for our 8-hour day and has helped protect our hearing. Now think about large compressors and hammers and confined spaces. And as that goes up, the guys with Red Horse, they wear earplugs and muffs. And you're not going to get the full reduction from both, but you need to consider that we're trying to slow that impact of knocking down those small hairs in your ears that are there for protection and not vibrating the heck out of our eardrum and doing more damage. We need to do better with hearing conservation. Be safe out there. For this week in the news, let's talk about the Native American sovereign nations and their need to be able to use their water. And that's going to jump right into the money that was just released for the Navajo Nation. The federal government has awarded $73 million in contracts to construct pumping plants as part of an ongoing project to bring drinking water to parts of the Navajo Nation and to residents in northwestern New Mexico. The Bureau of Reclamation announced at the end of September that an Arizona company earned the contract to build 2 pumping plants on the Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project. The plants will be situated near the Navajo community of San Nasti in San Juan County. They will be part of a network of pipelines and pumping stations that will deliver treated water from the San Juan River. This money comes from the federal infrastructure law. The Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project will use about 280 miles of pipeline, pumping stations, storage tanks, and 2 treatment plants to deliver water to chapters of the Navajo Nation and the city of Gallup. It is expected to be completed by the Bureau of Reclamation in 2027. The project is a major component of the nation's water rights settlement agreement of 2010 on the San Juan River Basin in New Mexico. The Navajo Nation won their right to use water from their watershed of the San Juan River Basin, which is connected to Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, all 3 water-stressed states navigating between the Colorado River and the San Juan River Compact. The settlement was signed into law by the Obama administration in 2009, executed in 2010, and then took till 2013 to be finalized. And now it's 10 years later. They're entitled to 633,532 acre feet of water. Mind you, the Navajo Gallup Water Supply Project that we're talking about today only requires 22,650 acre feet to supply the people of Gallup and the Navajo Nation. In 2003, there was a study that about 30% of the Navajo population did not have piped water to their homes. Today, it is about 15%. The water rights settlement and construction authorization for the Navajo Nation to utilize San Juan River Basin water was executed and finalized in 2013. And here we are, almost 10 years into the making, and still another 5 years from getting these people the water they need. Two-thirds of the households still haul water today in the nation. Without piped water, residents haul water either from regulated watering points or unregulated water sources, such as livestock wells, windmill wells, and springs. The number of unregulated water sources in the Navajo Nation is estimated to be in the low thousand. The rural terrain and sparse population in many of these areas pose unique challenges for traditional piped water solutions. It is estimated to make it so that we have piped water to all the homes in this area is 700 million. And this is their right to have drinking water and basic sanitation at your home. Think about this. This is a sovereign nation. Some of the first people in North America. This is their water. And we've seen this with water rights discussions and water plants discussions in the East Coast and up into Alaska and in Oklahoma. And this is a very important thing. The Navajo Nation and the federal agencies continue to work together to implement novel approaches to address the vitality of this important issue. In accordance with the Safe Drinking Water Act, these unregulated water sources are susceptible to bacteria contamination, including fecal coliform. Some of these unregulated water sources also exceed water standards for uranium and other chemicals, including naturally occurring chemicals. Consumption of unregulated water is reportedly widespread due to the lack of regulated water systems in more remote and sparsely populated regions of the Navajo Nation. Again, they're hauling water from wherever they can get water to provide for their families. And this is the place that is now their home and their nation. This is very big and very important for us to understand that as we start looking at underserved communities throughout the country and access to safe drinking water and sanitation, that our Native American nations are having the same issues, and we should all be aware of it, and we should be working on it too. For this week's featured story, we have a featured industry professional, Jesse Richardson, who is legal counsel for the Water System Council. And I'm very excited to have him on again, because at the Jubilee, we talked about his top three. And now, today being October 3rd, they're starting the opening arguments for Sackett versus the EPA at the United States Supreme Court. Jesse, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
I'm going to jump right into this. How did you get into law and legislation for water and the environment? How did that become one of your passions?
Well, it's a great story. I was, I've always been interested in agricultural law, and my major is agricultural economics in college. And agriculture is the biggest user of water, so I had that in my background. But I was in private law practice, and I got a client who the public water supply was right beside my client's farm. They were pumping groundwater from an abandoned limestone quarry, and that caused sinkholes on my client's property, and the stream dried up and the spring dried up. And so I represented my client. We filed a lawsuit in Virginia, and the Virginia Supreme Court hadn't decided what water rights rule for groundwater applied in the state yet. And I thought for sure that we were going to come up with the Richardson rule, because I thought for sure this was going to go to the Virginia Supreme Court and make law. But ended up settling the case. And at that time, this was in the mid 1990s, water was just starting to be a hot issue in Virginia. And it was kind of like a domino effect that somebody asked my client about a water lawyer. He said, "See Jesse Richardson." And then somebody asked them, and ended up that I started doing work for the South Atlantic Jubilee and for the Water Systems Council, and had the opportunity to work on legal and legislative issues, not only in Virginia and West Virginia, but across the country. And I just really loved it because it's very arcane. And we're still relying on some cases from in my case that I had in Virginia. The judge cited a case from the 1600s in England, and so that was really cool to me. It's very complex. It just was something that took over my brain, and I haven't been able to control it.
That is really fascinating. So in July, we met at the South Atlantic Drilling Jubilee, and you had three big topics that were coming into what we were going to see in the fall. And that was the waters of the United States, Sackett versus the EPA, and the Western drought. What has changed with the waters of the United States since July? Anything big that we should be thinking about?
Nothing has really changed in that respect. We're all looking forward to Sackett, and the Biden administration hasn't done anything on the proposed rule that they put forth. So nothing's changed on that.
Okay, so let's talk Sackett versus the EPA.
Yep, coming up real soon. We're going to have oral arguments on that, and going to be an interesting case. So I have to start, as you know, as we've already talked about, it all starts with Rapanos in 2006. And in that decision, the court was looking at a wetland that there was a navigable water some distance away. It was connected to the wetland by a series of non-navigable ditches and streams and a navigable stream. So it was kind of an attenuated connection. And the court came out with a 4-1 to 4 decision. And the plurality decision, because this decision and the one vote from the concurring decision said that they had to reverse and remand the case. That decision said that, and that was written by Justice Scalia, said that you only have a navigable water or a jurisdictional water when the wetland has a constant surface connection to the navigable water. And so basically, it has to abut, the wetland has to abut the navigable water. Justice Scalia rejected the EPA definition of adjacency, which allowed for it to be separated by berms or roads or other types of separations. And it said more, it had to be in the general area. And Justice Scalia also said that navigable water has to be continuously flowing, not intermittent. And so in this case, Justice Scalia said that this would not be a waters of the United States because there was a physical separation. The dissenting opinion got 4 votes, and the dissenting opinion would basically have deferred to the EPA on the adjacency issue and on the determination that this wetland was waters of the United States. So polar opposite. So then we get Justice Kennedy. He's the 1 vote. So this ended up 4-1-4. And Justice Kennedy didn't agree with Justice Scalia and the plurality, and he didn't agree with the dissenting opinion 100%. He agreed that the case needed to be sent back to the lower court, but his reasoning was that, yes, this is adjacent. I accept the court's definition of adjacency, but if it's an adjacent wetland, it's only waters of the United States if there is a substantial nexus between the waters of the United States and this wetland. And that substantial nexus means that there has to be some chemical, I want to look at this to make sure I get it right. The wetlands, either alone or in combination with similarly situated lands in the area, must significantly affect the chemical, physical, and biological integrity of other covered waters more readily identified as navigable. So Rapanos left everybody scratching their heads a little bit, 4-1-4. And so when later cases had to make decisions on adjacent wetlands or wetlands that were in close to these navigable waters, the court said, what test do we apply? How do we figure this out? And the vast majority of the lower courts have said, we're going to go with the test that is the most narrow. And the test that is the most narrow here is Justice Kennedy's significant nexus test. So the vast majority of courts have applied the significant nexus test to determine whether an adjacent wetland is navigable and therefore subject to jurisdiction of the EPA. And if you fill that wetland or deal with that wetland, you would have to get a permit before you do that. So you can just stop me if I'm rambling too much or if you want to interject anything. So that was 16 years ago. And the courts have muddled their way through. There's really no clear test at this point. Significant nexus is kind of subjective. Now here comes the Sacketts, and they have already been to the United States Supreme Court once. This will be their second trip. They purchased some land that was soggy, and they commenced to build some residential dwellings. And the EPA came in and said, whoa, wait a minute. That's a wetland. You can't fill that wetland without a permit, so you need to get a permit. Well, this litigation's been going on almost since Rapanos. It's been going on for a long time.
2007, yeah.
Yeah, and so finally, you know, years and years later, here we are again. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decided that they were going to use the significant nexus test. And they determined that using that test, the soggy area on the Sacketts property is a wetland. And there's a lake across the street So there's a road separating the wetlands from this lake that is clearly navigable water. And they said, well, that's adjacent under the EPA test, and there's a significant nexus, so you have to get a permit, Sackett. Now, it's interesting to note that before the Ninth Circuit made this decision, that the EPA withdrew their letter of enforcement and said, we're not going to enforce this anymore. And so the EPA argued that this is a moot case now. We're not moving against the Sacketts. They basically cried uncle and said, we give up. And the court said, well, you know, just because you tell the Sacketts that you're not going to enforce it doesn't mean that you might later change your mind. And this is still an open question, so we're going to hear the case. After the Ninth Circuit decided the case, the Sacketts appealed it to the United States Supreme Court. And the Sacketts' argument is the significant nexus test should not be applied. The court should apply Justice Scalia's test that it has, that the wetland has to physically abut the navigable water. And the United States Supreme Court decided that they would hear the case. And the question presented to the court is whether the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals applied the correct test. So this is an opportunity for the court to come in and say, here's what you lower court should do from here on in. Here's how you should deal with these cases.
This is big because, as a water geek, I've listened to all of the Water of the United States roundtables, and plenty of them have been about femoral streams and farmland that is it soggy or is it wetland, and can it be tiled? Can it not be tiled? And a lot of this has to do with us being able to develop properties or not develop properties. And again, this is when a corporation looks at purchasing the appropriate permits, it's a good legal representation and a couple $100,000, and for somebody to buy a property. So, there's the dichotomy of we need to protect wetlands, navigable waters, and watersheds. And at the same time, there is, if I have a 2-acre property that I'm trying to be part of a lake community, but now we've determined that it's, a significant nexus, it's very hard to know what side to be on this as a contractor or a driller or, just a common homeowner.
Yeah, the landowner is got a lot of uncertainty. When, is this, do I need to get a permit or not? And if I do, like you said, it could be hundreds of thousands of dollars. So that's something you don't want to go into lightly.
The EPA just enforced in Massachusetts a few weeks ago on the Charles River, the Mystic River, the Neponset, that there were discharge there that is running into those rivers and going into the watershed, and they want them to get proper permits. And right here we just have the Sacketts wanting to fill in some soggy areas. They're not trying to discharge or anything.
Right. And I think the important thing for a lot of people who might be listening here from the groundwater industry is that the significant nexus test could mean that groundwater is waters of the United States. And it could mean that any type of discharge to groundwater, you have to get a permit. And that includes any accidental discharge. And so that raises a lot of uncertainty. And some people might think, who but a bunch of lawyers would say that groundwater is navigable? And that's true, but at least one court has said, the District Court of Hawaii, they said that this groundwater has a significant nexus to the navigable water. So we think this groundwater in this case is waters of the United States. Okay. So in the future, we could have the same thing. We could, if the court says continue to apply this significant nexus test, we don't know what the future for groundwater is. And I'll note at this point that the Biden administration, they proposed a rule to define waters of the United States back at the end of 2021. And the comment period ran on that in February of 2022. In that rule, unlike the rule that was promulgated by the Obama administration and the rule promulgated by the Trump administration, groundwater is not explicitly exempt from the definition of waters of the United States. And when you read the footnotes, they say that given this Maui County case, where indirect discharges might require a permit, we don't think we can exempt groundwater. So given the Sackett case and the proposed Biden administration rule, groundwater is in play right now.
We could talk about this all day. I think we're at a great stopping point. I really appreciate your time today, Jesse, and we'd love to have you back on, you know, as the Sackett case rolls forward, you know, maybe into the November time period when they're ready to make a determination, or if this, how long do you think this case will go for?
Well, they're going to argue it in November. I'm anticipating we'll get a decision in early 2023, February or March, probably.
Okay, we'll catch you at the NGWA and see if we can't learn some more. Thank you so much for all the knowledge you've shared with us today.
Thank you, Brock. I appreciate you inviting me, and you always are very knowledgeable and have great questions. I love discussing water issues with you.
It's a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks.
I'd like to thank you for joining us for episode 31 of the Driller Newscast. Huge thanks to Jesse Richardson for coming on and educating us. Once again, we need to be up on our laws, legislation, who's advocating correctly, who's not, and what we can be doing to educate our customers, our friends, our neighbors, our family, and the rest of the industry. Check out thedriller.com. It's always great new content coming out. Have a safe, smart work week. And when you put on that hard hat and those safety glasses and those gloves, grab that hearing protection. We can all work on the job site. I know we use a lot of hand signals, but we need to think about hearing conservation. And think about that statistic about many 25-year-olds in the construction industry have done enough damage to their hearing already that they have the hearing health of a 50-year-old. It's no good. Have a great week.